Welcome to Regulatory Ramblings. At the heart of today's discussion is the question, can fintech help solve the social, financial, and economic problems that baby boomer finance has created for the world? Will Generation Z's potentially decentralized world look very different to ours? Generation Z, or Z, some call it, or now Generation Alpha, will grow up in a world designed and run almost exclusively by baby boomers in most of the developed world. For example, the DBS outage was supposedly caused by a missing generation unable to take over during the crisis. Why did these octogenarian organizational men create huge lumbering bureaucracies which fintech has been having problems countering? Economists for almost a century now have struggled to understand why organizations exist. Massive central banks, financial supervisors, regulators, and now new stability boards pile on to gigantic financial services firms like BlackRock, Visa, and Allianz. And post-2008, distrust of the financial sector is understandable. Yet scale, too, has its benefits even outside the financial world, as Google and YouTube have shown, and this shows no signs of abating. Payment apps on our mobile phones still go through the old architecture of an earlier age, using the same old rules. When you turn on MetaMask and use Ethereum, you get a whole different feeling. Thousands of decentralized autonomous organizations, or DAOs, are creating tokens that can be used for almost anything you want. Our guest today brings an alternative view of finance and the economy in a decentralized finance or DeFi world. All too often we hear the conservative viewpoint of fintech, which is oftentimes a mild veneer of technology over a lot of archaic yesterday's forms and the current state of doing banking and finance. Yet the law and economics of DeFi could look very different from what's currently envisaged. Dr. Brian Michael is a senior research fellow at HKU's Faculty of Law and also teaches at Oxford University. An economist and jurist by training, Dr. Michael has been in finance most of his life. In recent times, his focus has been trying to understand how Web3-based fintech can help developing countries' sustainable development. For example, how Web3 technologies, tokenization, and algorithms can help the poor and downtrodden in jurisdictions without functioning governments and effective financial systems, in terms of aiding them leapfrog over their UN sustainable development goals. Using econometric analysis, he poses questions like whether such technologies might help sweep away old centralized economic and financial institutions. I won't bore you with his many accomplishments. He has many accolades, and he's had a truly remarkable career. And with that, we'll post a copy of his biography to our webpage. With that, Brian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I suppose we should just probably dive into it. Can you describe the two schools of thought when it comes to fintech regulation? You've described them as the conservative prevailing IMF, BIS perspective, and then the more up and coming Web3 optimistic viewpoint of the techno evangelists and the youthful libertarians who want to push forward. Could you flesh that out a bit more?
Sure. So when you look online and you're a policymaker, you're just someone interested in the subject. You look online, you look at an IMF working paper or World Bank working paper, and it says, this is how fintech is going to help the government. This is how it's going to help the health sector. This blah, 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 right? And you look at all the recommendations, and it's just the same using banks, but using more efficient technology. It's like what e-government was to government, you know? So what they're asking us to do is to apply new internet technologies, wireless technologies, mobile technologies, what the teenagers of today wouldn't even consider modern technologies, right? that they want, they're asking policymakers to apply those to organizations that have been around for literally two centuries. And that is the fintech solution of what I've called the conservative view of international organizations like the Bank for International Settlements, the IMF, in most national governments as well, because you're 30, you're 40 years old, it's what you know, it's safe. No, you know, it's no one's going to get hurt. So let's just kind of take it one step at a time. And so that kind of characterizes the conservative approach. Yeah, I can discuss the evangelistic approach if you're interested.
Yes, please.
Okay. So in contrast to this approach, you have what I've called the evangelists. These are the techno bros that you see in the Miami parties, the Bitcoin parties, right? And they say that Bitcoin and Ethereum, and it's going to revolutionize our lives, man. And this is the future if you want to be a millionaire. And so when you hear these techno bros, I mean, they even appear on shows like Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. And, you know, if a theme is making this show, you know that it's really something that's kind of in the mainstream. And in this techno bro evangelistic view of the world, they see Bitcoin, they see fintech as Bitcoin, as cryptocurrency, and they miss the whole Web3 aspect, the whole aspect that's sitting on the internet. There's a whole other layer, if you will, that consists of these things we call distributed ledger technologies. We can go into the details if you're really interested later, but the basic idea is that you've got this kind of subcurrent of blockchain users of this different technology, this kind of network, less open technology. It's not like your Facebook, it's not like your YouTube. And it's this technology, this blockchain technology, where all these new innovations are riding, which includes Bitcoin, Ethereum, and even some new machine learning protocols, which are being used in collaboration with them. So the evangelists say that level, that Web3 level, man, that's the future. And if you're not there, you're just going to be out. So that's how I've kind of contrasted these two schools of thought.
Okay, I think that gives us a useful summary of the two, broadly speaking, the two camps. So then the question becomes, what can DeFi do? And can DeFi solve the quote-unquote public goods or the missing regulators problem? And can it create trustless local financial markets? And if so, how?
Yes, so DeFi, it's a whole different way of thinking about finance. Now, think I'm from Texas, right? And, you know, in Texas, you can make tacos, you can build houses, you can do lots of different things. And then you think, well, how do we exchange value in an economy like that? And it's hard for me to say, okay, I'm going to build you half a house if you give me 100 tacos. So we had to settle on this thing called a currency, yeah, a store of value, there's three aspects to a currency, which are escaping me now. But basically, you've got to have some kind of, we do call it a numeraire, basic thing that we can exchange in value, is such that, you know, transactions, production, and consumption can get going, right?
Right.
Now, that's all settled. Now, what would have happened if I wrote up a ticket for one taco and I could trade that as freely like currency to you if you built a house, or I gave it for part participation in a mining stake, or I used it to enter into a nightclub one night? What if that one sheet of paper could serve all those different functions all at the same time? That is what tokens are. That is what the modern day equivalent of money and crypto and everything we keep hearing about with the bros I was saying earlier, that's what they're trading and they're holding. They're holding sets of numbers that basically function like these pieces of paper I was telling you about. You know, you could have a stake in a house just as easily as you could a bag of yen worth $10 million, right? And so that's the kind of completely new way that fintech and innovation is changing the way we think about money. Now, how does DeFi come into the picture? Yeah. Well, DeFi comes into the picture. And why did I talk about tech? Why did I start the story with Texas? The reason why I started the story with Texas is because I can make my papers. You, or sitting there in Chennai or in Mexico City or in Japan, Osaka, wherever you are, you can make your own little papers too, right? And if we can agree to trade these papers, if we at that time 100 years ago had some kind of amazing magical exchange which would just automatically convert the value of these papers, yeah, which we know today's exchanges, which we actually have online, this is exactly what crypto and token exchanges do. They automatically change the value of Bitcoin into Solana into this, that, and the other. Yeah. And right. So you make your little paper in your own little region through some magic. It's automatically transferable into a key to the local government sponsored swimming pool or into a beautiful Japanese food restaurant. And suddenly, all service, all production, consumption, trade, transfer, it's all local. It's DeFi, it's decentralized finance. You can actually make all your own public services, your own private services, and there's no need for the kind of national institution like the one that we've been usefully relying on for over, since the Treaty of Westphalia, what was it, 1660 something, long time ago. So,
yeah, 1567, something like that. It's interesting you bring up Texas. I mean, because you mentioned you are from Texas, I want to take a temporary detour. I mean, tell us a little bit about yourself, though. I mean, what was it like growing up in Texas? I mean, you're a Harvard-trained economist, undergrad Harvard, PhD Oxford. You're currently a research fellow at HKU's Faculty of Law, but you also teach at Oxford. I mean, you know, broadly speaking, trace the contours of your career and how you, I mean, and I've always valued our connection for the past decade that I've known you, and how you've become an economist who focuses on the efficacy of regulation, what makes for good regulation, what makes for efficient regulation, what are the costs of regulation. Describe that journey, because there's any number of things someone with your background could be doing, and you do consult with a lot of the world's premier institutions and governments.
You're very kind. Thank you. I grew up in El Paso, Texas, and it's, as you know, it's separated from a Mexican town called Juarez by a river, the Rio Grande. Yeah. And you can actually look into Mexico from your house in El Paso. You can look into Juarez, where there's thousands of people living in these shacks. These shanty areas where they don't have access to clean water, sanitation, to food, where violence is rife. Depending on the year, you shouldn't even travel across the bridge because you might get shot due to gang violence, et cetera. So, you know, and then you cross over that bridge in El Paso and you visit your aunt, and it's this huge house, this 8-bedroom house that, you know, why would anyone need this with these huge lawns, you know, and servants, domestic, I mean, for all intents and purposes, they're treated like servants, but they are Mexican or Latin American immigrants who have come to work in the United States, and specifically El Paso. They can go through very freely. There's a free exchange agreement between Juarez and El Paso. But the question that is always in your head is the same as any young man growing up in an apartheid system, is why am I here and this person's over there, you know? And, you know, in our generation, we try to treat them the same, just like us, because we know it's just a lottery, but we know that, but for the grace of God, but for the grace of a geography, we could be switched, right?
Exactly. Lines on maps matter. And I mean, what's the difference between San Diego and Tijuana? just that line, but I mean, it's a different world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so then I was lucky enough to study with a guy called Jeffrey Sachs, who was a Harvard-based economist who was advising Russia, Poland, and Bolivia originally, but he advised a lot of countries make the transition from socialism, communism to free market, capitalist, semi-democratic systems.
A lot of what he advocated involved shock therapy, which he's in the intervening years, he seems to have, he seems to acknowledge his past mistakes. The Chicago School never did, unfortunately.
It's a controversial subject. Yeah. If you were him, you would say it worked in Poland, it didn't work in Russia, but it's a complicated issue. Sure. But for a young man of 19, 20 years old, you know, to have this room where there's a secret fax machine, and you go in and you see, you know, the president of the Russian Federation, and just guys, you know, academics slipping in and out and doing equations, and, you know, they seem like masters of the universe. And you say, well, if I had this power, I could make it. Yeah, it's the Thanos syndrome, right? That every young man has. If I had the five rings of the Thanos power, I too could make the ideal world. And, you know, I guess we all have this just conceit at one point or another. So
it's interesting you mentioned that. I mean, that's reminiscent of Madeleine Albright's statement to Colin Powell once. I think he stayed on the Joint Chiefs for a little bit when early in the Clinton administration, where she said something to the effect of, what's the point of having all this power if we can't use it? And Powell just about did a facepalm, according to his memoir, which was released in mid-90s. But so you're in that environment. It's heady. You do feel like, you know, walking the corridors of power gives you a degree of power in terms of the policies you shape. But describe being a young man and what that was like. I mean, well, how intoxicating that could be.
Economics started with a bunch of Russian mathematicians, basically, with something called input-output matrices. And what they said is that if you had the perfect equations, the perfect data, you could create the perfect economy. And even now, two centuries later, that is still the gold model, the optimum, the main thing that we compare all our advice to is the central planner's solution, is the mathematical optimum. Is this set of equations that come together and, you know, some nerd somewhere finds the best outcome. And we'll always compare everything to that, even now. And, you know, you're 19, 20 years old and you're given these tools, much like a medical doctor must feel a bit like God, I would imagine, when they get the tools of their trade, you know, knowing one could solve.
From having known them. Yeah.
Well, knowing that, you know, the kids you used to play with when you were small, you could go back and just solve it all for them because now you have it's right here. What all you need is right here. And, you know, it's a very, very interesting time to be around, I think.
Okay. Now, it's interesting you mentioned, say, a token being worth one taco. I mean, at the end of the day, it comes down to what labor can produce, how much labor it takes to produce that one taco. Some might say then, isn't this all Marx's labor theory of value? And I think, was it the city of Milwaukee or Madison, Wisconsin, that tried this, that you were able to swap Milwaukee hours or Madison hours for, you know, favors or services, and what it showed was that even within you're an economist, you know what I'm getting at, even a closed circuit economy, and you saw this in the Soviet Union as well, even in a closed circuit economy you can get inflation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So is it fair to equate it with Marx's labor theory of value, or
no, Marx's labor theory of value was debunked 100 years ago. No credible economist would even mention it, and the reason for that is because supply has to always follow demand. Demand never follows supply. The customer knows what he wants.
So it's interesting. I mean, and the hardcore academics would probably appreciate this nuanced point that in terms of their analysis, you know, your Adam Smith, David Ricardo types, you know, the classical school and the Marxists, my sense is that the classical school would say 97% of the value of a good came from labor. The remaining 3% is time, risk, you know, reward for the entrepreneur. Whereas with the Marxists, it was 100% came from, you know, the value of labor.
So the modern economist believes value comes from two things. The second thing is going to be related to our discussion today. The first component of value is the intellectual input, the intellectual property. You have a new idea for a train or a spaceship, and that idea contains in it 99% of the value. Now, hands in themselves have very little value. It's the brain part. So that's what we call total factor productivity. The second and part, the part which is more relevant to our discussion, I think, is the collective value. The fact that you working and me working separately, we just cannot achieve an economic value that we can if we were able to pool our resources together and create something that economists call public goods. We have goods that many people contribute to and in turn can use profitably to make their lives better. Those are the SDGs. The Sustainable Development Goals, for example, are examples of the problems these public goods try to solve.
Okay. Now, you previously shared with me that business as usual will fail because of politics. Could you elaborate on that?
Business as usual will fail because of politics. Do you remember what we were talking about roughly at the time?
I think it was, I mean, from I took from that the younger generation will not stand for norms set in a different age.
When it comes
to banking, when it comes to the structure of the economy, when it comes to allocation of resources, and ultimately what they regard as fair, because this is the world we are handing on to them.
Yes, I think we see a lot more of this in the discourse, not only in the U.S. but in Europe, et cetera, is that we have basically 80-year-olds making the institutions and the decisions that are going to be affecting three generations behind them, right? And so you've got in some what we call this this intergenerational conflict or intergenerational disequilibria, where the oldest guys are getting too much or an unreasonable share of their goodies at the expense of future generations. And that is what the UN calls unsustainable. In the Brundtland Commission, they define sustainable development as being able to enjoy one's resources without the taking away the ability of future generations to enjoy the resources. And that is a political problem, right? More than an economic problem. And so how one gets around that is going to determine the shape of our economy and business for decades to come.
Well, you see shades of this in the latest Republican debates in the U.S. with Nikki Haley saying for her children's generation, she would raise the retirement age. But clearly, once they start working, they're going to be paying the benefits of earlier age cohorts, but they're not going to be able to draw anywhere near as close to the same benefits, because they're not going to get, in her view, cost of living adjustments. They're going to get adjustments tied to inflation, not the same thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So what do you do as a young person, right?
Yeah.
I mean, do you just put in your CV to Citibank, to Goldman Sachs, to the Congress as some kind of intern and hope for the best? Or do you go with this new trend where you see all your friends becoming CEOs overnight of these amazing token crypto ventures? And, you know, with most of the developed world at roughly 25% unemployment in the under 25 segment, you see quite clearly where the future's headed to, right? It's not toward these massive institutions that we were talking about at the start of our discussion, but this decentralized, not just finance, but decentralized institutions in themselves, I think.
Will decentralized organizations, DAOs, I believe is the acronym, will they help small and medium enterprises?
Well, let's...
I mean, do the movements go in tandem? Is it necessarily what the evolution of one will strengthen SMEs against the larger corporates or no?
I guess I'd like to make two points. The first point is right now, DAOs are SMEs. There are none that are mammoths, as we think about mammoths like BlackRock, Blackstone, BlackRock. I always forget which Black is which. that's the first point. The second more important point, though, is roughly 40% of the world doesn't live under a functioning government, some kind of government that can assure their safety, survival, their access to the basic needs of everyday life. They don't live in a system where they, if they manage to scrape together $2 a day, they can put it somewhere where they'll get $3 next year. They just don't have access to these things. So DAOs and this kind of proto-fintech, that's all they've got. That's their last hope. That's their only chance, right? And so it's not a question of, well, are they SMEs? Can they be big big thing, big organizations. The point is that it's either fintech or it's nothing. And that's it.
Pretty binary choice. I mean, I didn't want to fixate too much on the acronyms and nomenclature, but, you know, in contemporary times, that's what people want to know. Like, what are we talking about? What are the labels? Because sadly, people tend to distill it down and conceptualize based on, you know, certain labels and terms. And then, oh, okay, yeah, I get it. That's what you're talking about. But even fintech to many seems like a pretty nebulous term, which is a good segue into our next question, in that, you know, certainly in the common law world, there's a pretty established body of jurisprudence as to what traditional property rights constitute. There's very little of the law that's, in that regard, that's undecided, that's gray. It's being contested. Along come fintech and regtech, and so the question of the 21st century is, what will that mean for traditional property rights, as well as pricing mechanisms and modes of financing? What are your thoughts?
Exactly. So I have thoughts that are very much based on history. So these are personal thoughts more than anything else. I personally think that fintech has been overregulated far too soon. I think that we saw a crypto winter. We saw lots of old ladies lose their pensions, and there was enormous political pressure for regulators to do something. Now, what is to do something? And the answer is take this body of law, legislation, regulation that we already have, and just apply it to this new thing that's just starting to develop. You know? And if we would have waited, we might have seen a fintech trajectory go into a completely different path than the kind of what I call institutionalist path that we see that has already emerged. But it can't do that. It's already locked in. And economists actually call this the QWERTY problem. Maybe you've heard of this from keyboards. You heard of QWERTY.
What is the QWERTY problem?
So QWERTY, QWERTY, the QWERTY problem.
Yeah, now, the QWERTY keyboard. Yeah.
Everyone knows it's an inefficient way of organizing letters on a type board. You could type faster if they were organized a different way. Now, right. Why are they kept this way? And the answer is because we have this kind of lock-in to this keyboard. We were trained, our parents were trained to use this style so the hammers wouldn't stick together as they hit the old style pages on the manual typewriters, right? Yeah. So you had to have this QWERTY layout in order so that people could type normally. Now, along come computers, everyone knows how to type on QWERTY keyboards. So QWERTY it is. And then off with the children. And in our institutions, our economic institutions work exactly the same way, is that if, like you showed me today, you sent me a crypto NFT, it's a web page that kind of covers news in Hong Kong about crypto and non-fungible tokens. And the headlines are all about how international security regulator or BlackRock expands its crypto footprint. These are the QWERTYs. These are the locked-in institutions that already have this major advantage that can simply just kind of cherry-pick and take any of these extra bonuses of fintech without letting the system potentially jump on to its more efficient evolution if we just gave it time for BlackRock to stay away and for things to evolve potentially in a more efficient, decentralized way. And that's just a proposition. I can't prove that at all.
No, but that's an interesting proposition, because fundamentally, legacy customs, processes, standards, ways of doing things are impinging on technology. And I think the implicit assumption here is if those legacy practices were not in the way, you could take the reins off and technology could go a lot further, a lot quicker, and achieve a lot more.
Potentially.
Potentially, yeah.
And what I might say is that for these 40 countries in the world that don't have a working government, and for the 70 countries that don't have working financial markets, this is their only hope. It's either this or nothing, you know? So they're going to have to make peace with it somehow.
And many have, right? That they've leapfrogged from traditional phone lines to digital communications.
Exactly.
And that's how many in the developing world access the internet.
Exactly.
Through their phones and financial services such as they exist in those countries. So then we come to the implications of computer code as law. And it makes some people squeamish because in the common law world, the attitude is, okay, legislatures make law and occasionally judges also make law, but computer code is law. The way it hits the ears, it rubs people the wrong way, because they're just not used to it. It's not part of the status quo, the current way of doing things.
And I guess it's a problem of oversimplification, right? Is that the law has a certain internal structure, if I may expound on the majesty of the law for a moment. It has its own internal structure. You have the constitutional values, which then define the legislative boundaries set up by the kind of rules of the game established in the Constitution. The regulations, they give the specifics of the legislation that the Congress or legislation defines. And then the regulatory authorities and those below them, they continue more specific, et cetera. Or you have parties to contracts. And there's a whole bunch of different areas you can talk about in the law. But there's this idea that we're going from social values, things that we must agree on as a society to live together, to the specifics about if I give you a share on Monday, do I get my money on Tuesday, Wednesday, or do we have to swap hand by hand? I give you the share and you give me the money, right? These are very technical rules.
But critical ones, because people are like, yeah, what does this new tech mean for delivery?
Well, the technical rules, I'm positive, eventually will be worked out through some kind of compromise. Yeah. Okay. And I think which will be based on efficiency or which will be based on God knows. I mean, we're talking about a subject that's very specific, very general. The point I want to make, though, is that those higher level values, that will be something that computers will not be able to. We cannot code those constitutional values into our economic, social, and political systems as easily as we can code the exchange of securities for cash. Right. So I think it's a question we don't. It philosophically, okay, you can sit and dream about how many angels can dance on a pin all day long. But for right now, the focus is on how do we increase productivity, efficiency, blah, blah. And that's where ChatGPT comes in. That's where that debate comes in. And that's why that debate's relevant. Whereas in the debate about why machine learning isn't taking over some kind of piece of legislation somewhere, right? That's the reason why we have this emphasis in our political and journalistic dialogue, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's just part of the agreed terms of discourse, but oftentimes that can be pretty confining. If you want to talk about something new and cutting edge, and it's like, forget getting people to conceptually understand where you're coming from. Sometimes it feels as though, especially if you're novice, you're groping, you're grasping for the terms, the concept, the nomenclature to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the case for many of us who aren't techies. And brings me to my next question, which is, if we project to the world of 2050, mid-century, and the brave new world of fintech, which will presumably have progressed further,
mm-hmm.
who will be the winners of that environment, and what will it mean for Generation Z, or the Zoomers, as folks like Peter Zion like to call them, who will presumably be running the show by that point?
Well, personally, I think it depends what kind of compromise we reach on the second Gilded Age that we're in right now, right? Fintech, as I was saying, it can go in two directions. It can go the classical way. It can go the evangelistic way. It can lead to increases in income disparities, or it can lead to decreases in income disparities, right? We know that the population of China is going to be roughly one quarter by 2050. What are we?
By about 2050, the expectation is, yeah, it'll be about 650 million.
Exactly. So we're going to see huge areas of the globe start to depopulate. We're seeing huge increases in productivity, which are then expanding exponentially because of AI. So we have GDP per person radically increasing, right? What education's doing is uncertain, because everyone is now using YouTube instead of studying. So I think the outlook for fintech and for economic progress in 2050?
Yeah,
in
mid-century.
It looks good if you're some country like the U.S. that's positioned to take care of it, and it looks awful if you're some region like Yemen or most of sub-Saharan Africa, where even if you just plop all of this technology and all of these experts down tomorrow, it would all just vanish within 20 to 30 years. It's a shame that that's just how it is. Right?
So for some parts of the world, no amount of technology, no amount of capital, no amount of know-how is going to save them? Is that a fair statement?
Not if you just plunk it down and say, here you go. Go at it, boys.
But what if we start now? Is there a chance that they could say, for example, avoid the middle income trap? I mean, as an economist, you know, but basically it's the notion that certain countries reach a certain standard of living, a certain income level, and maybe incrementally they add to that year upon year, but they never quite break gravity. They never quite rise above that level. We've seen that in certain African countries, certainly Latin America. Is there a chance that they can defy gravity and go on to grow and thrive and prosper if they have access to that fintech now?
If their ethnic and color and every other possible difference they define themselves by disappears, then yes, absolutely. Right? I mean, the typical story, especially, there's a school of thought in France. It's called the Tiers-Mondiste School of Development. And what they say, Third Worlder School of Development. And what they say is that the reason why these poor countries are poor is because one ethnicity wants to get the money, they take the money, they get all the money, the other ethnicities don't get the money. And you go to the U.S. and you see, well, we had a Clinton, we had another Clinton, we had two Bushes. You know, you don't have to go to Africa to see kind of this grabbing of resources by an ethnicity family clan or partisan of something or the other. It's everywhere, right? And by some miracle, it hasn't completely impoverished us in the U.S., although it almost did during the Civil War. Whereas in Africa, then this kind of political compromise has nowhere close to become being resolved. And we know this because we see all their money in Swiss bank accounts. It's just that simple.
Interesting you cite the U.S. example, because my sense was a great deal of wealth was generated. If you were positioned right, you made out like a bandit during the Civil War. Mm-hmm. If you were in the right sector, right industry. That period of Republican dominance from 1896 to 1932, okay, it was an era of corruption and market rigging, but that was a time when great fortunes were made.
Yes.
And, you know, certainly if we look at those we considered old money and on the, you know, Forbes list of wealthiest families, that they certainly did, you know, those fortunes were certainly created during that time. But yeah, you know, your point's well taken it's amazing it hasn't impoverished the U.S. just yet. My sense was, though, that it came to a breaking point during the Depression, and I think it was surprising when you have someone on the right like Conrad Black writing in his biography of FDR that he saved capitalism, because the social contract, the bargain at that time was, if something isn't done, the U.S. could very quickly become a Marxist, you know, common society, and that it required the wealthy to give up some of their wealth for the common good.
Yeah, well, that's just politics.
Yeah, that's and which historical narrative one chooses to believe, but my sense was the breaking point was you know more during the Depression era than perhaps necessarily the Civil War, but. Be that as it may, you once said to me that there's a better way to implement fintech than to just computerize legacy financial institutions like JP Morgan Chase, HSBC, pick a banking juggernaut. Could you explain that further?
Yeah, just let Web3 evolve as it should. Don't pass laws that authorize BlackRock to file an application. They're allowed now, they're licensed to do this particular fintech thing, whereas in everyone else isn't. I mean, the economists, we believe as a creed that the free market, or free, it, all things being equal, free markets, free societies, free people will produce the best optimal level outcome. You know, that's the best we can do. And that government, once it starts distorting that and kind of crinkling it all up, we get these very bad outcomes. And to my mind, when I see only the big giants getting the licenses and the boys in El Paso who want to do the same thing to raise enough money so they can feed, you know, their friends across the border, when they're put in prison for doing this, you say to yourself, huh, well, maybe there's an economic political problem here where an unfreedom is creating this inequality. And that's it.
So a revolution. Okay, so if I'm understanding this correctly, then a revolution in fintech and regtech could spur economic growth and development such that in Mexico, such that they perhaps wouldn't need to come over the border to seek their futures.
Ideally.
I do.
Without a doubt.
Something else you previously suggested was that there's no possibility for young people today to have a say in shaping the financial architecture that will govern their generation, because, quote, the current approach simply shoves existing law onto digital markets instead of creating digitally native finance. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Sure. So about 2 or 3 years ago, it was an open question how regulators would deal with these new technologies, even with things like Bitcoin, you know, not to mention some types of machine learning algorithms or the offer of securities where they put crypto coins together and sold these packages like they did in the good old days, right? Well, we just didn't know. And it wasn't legal. It wasn't illegal. We just didn't know, right? And then we had this crypto winter where millions were cheated out of billions, and the law of the land now became the law of the digital world. And because that law of the digital world applies, we can't just suddenly wind it back tomorrow. We can't ask Congress to say, let's revert to the 2016 level. We're now trapped. So the best we can hope for is that some innovation will occur in the EU or in Asia, and it will be compelling enough such that we will eventually change our own rules in order to adapt or use or comply across borders, as we do every day. I mean, when I sit in the Ukraine, almost all the services I use are from the U.S., financial services, research services, you name it. And most of what we're going to, the fintech and all tech we're going to use in the future is not going to be from our own nation state. And that's just that.
Yeah. You once pointed out, I think this was, I don't know if you're being glib or flippant or, you know, just a moment of frustration, but the indignation was right there in your tone that 4 decades on and cross-border payments are still a challenge. Okay, that there is a lot of truth in that, depending on the jurisdiction. So what's the solution?
Oh, I'm not being flippant at all. I have many friends in the Ukraine when the war broke out, and I needed to send money to them. There was also an inflationary burst to Turkey at the same time. I had friends there. And to get money to them, I had to take money out of an ATM, go to a Western Union station place, get all this kind of verification. And, you know, this is the thing my father did when I was 18 years old and in trouble in Turkey, you know, when someone stole my wallet. Nothing has changed in that time period. And it's not because we don't have new technologies. It's because that we have a class of regulators or voters or whoever who are so afraid of know your customer, anti-terrorism, money laundering, because of all the potential dangers that could exist in the world, that they block these potential benefits from new technologies. That's the first point I'd like to bring. The second more important point I'd like to bring is that I as a Russian simply don't trust you as a Ukrainian. I as a Korean simply don't trust you as a Japanese. I as a Mexican simply don't trust you, whoever Mexico doesn't like. We're never going to see these international cooperation agreements with the free flow of money, remittances, without in the free and easy way we see within national borders, because these deep, because of international politics, every
the force of history, people are tribal. But if you can get them to trust the protocol, the underlying technology.
Well, there's always going to be an advantage to cheat. It's the prisoner's dilemma, right?
Right.
And that's it. We could all just do better if we open up the borders. But if I screw you a little bit, that's just going to make us that much richer. And that's what we keep doing year after year. And Western Union just keeps going and going.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that for all the all that people have said about crypto being an efficient way to transfer funds, you know, Western Union is still in business.
So in business, I can't buy my friends in Turkey can't buy anything with Bitcoin. They need to use some kind of exchange, which, oh, by the way, is either in the U.S. or located in some offshore whatever thing, right? Which I might bring up is the only solution we could have found to bring this new technology to us. It's not like Congress and our own great leaders have allowed these wonderful exchanges to develop. It was by the grace of the black markets, by the grace of this great post-imperial system where they tried to get around all the rules, that brought us the current joys and wonders of fintech as we know it. It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, I mean, clearly at some point the back roads, the side streets, the off ramps of the alternative financial system do have to merge with mainstream banking and finance, because at some point you want to interface with the mainstream economy. That requires fiat currency. And so you're going to have to convert some of some of your crypto, some of your virtual assets. I'd like to come to a statement you made previously. Quote: tokens are money, stocks, bonds, securities, they're keys. They can represent and open almost anything. Before the crypto winter, anything was possible. Millions joined fintech startups and went to their festivals to push their products. After scams shook out, the Hong Kong and Singapore fintech festivals felt like doing the same old thing, just with a different tech platform or motto or trick. For regulators, if the token was used like a share, it should be regulated and enforced like a share. So that seems to me to be a ringing endorsement of we ought to apply the traditional mainstream definition of what is a security to tokens. And you're comfortable with that?
No, then I'm completely against that. Okay. I think tokens should absolutely not be treated by their use. If they're used as a stock, they shouldn't just automatically fall under all the stock rules, right? Which they do now.
Right.
And they'll continue to do this. Now, what's happened is that if you went to the fintech festivals in Hong Kong and Singapore before the crypto winter, everyone was very excited. The regulators were very happy. And, you know, we're ready to build new markets and financial sectors and systems. And I was in both this year, and everyone just fled back into this old conservative definition of is that fintech is just traditional good old finance with a bit better computing power, and let's all just leave it there. Here's your free goodie that we'll hand out from our thing. You know, the government of Germany even gave me some kind of widget thing, you know, for their fintech. And everyone is just kind of having a face party because they know that fintech has gotten into this lull that reflects the old way of doing things.
Right.
And until something shakes it up somewhere, we're going to be in this lull. And that's the way it is.
Well, I mean, you were fortunate enough to attend both Hong Kong FinTech Week earlier this month and the Singapore FinTech Festival, which wrapped up last week. What were your overall impressions? Anything leap out at you? Anything make much of an impression? Anything you care to share that you thought was significant or novel or first impression?
Just the lack of dynamism that we've seen in the past. I mean, it was
in both.
In both. It was okay. More like a hungry couples, you know, bar, where you're looking for some kind of opportunity or the right thing to collaborate with or the right program to get into, right? So you have your stages, you have these enormous areas, the herds. It's like cattle management. You've got these herds of people from all over the world coming together, hoping to find that one right meeting that's going to change their world. And if before you really felt that potential, I think this year everyone was there just kind of like, yeah, we're here. It's the same. It's the thing we did last year. I mean, even the head of IMF, you know, in her opening presentation in Singapore, she was showing pictures of boats and, you know, it's the great unknown world and we're adopting fintech fast and let's see where we're going. We don't know. And that kind of set the tenor for the whole festival. And that's where we are. We're in a boat and we don't know where we're going. Stupid.
Interesting metaphor. I know plenty of people in this space that will actually eschew the industry organizations, or to the extent that they don't like them, but they, in some cases, they will maintain memberships because the attitude is, I'm going to be in this field, I need to be plugged in, and they will grudgingly even attend events like this, even though they know the attitude of many people is they're looking for funding. They're looking for investors. People are trying to get into each other's pockets at a lot of these conferences and conventions. And I guess that's par for the course. It comes with the territory, and one needs to acknowledge that. So in this mix of let Web3 do its thing, what's the role of CBDCs? Do they have a role, or is that just the state, nation state saying, no, we don't want to be left out of this development. We want fiat currency to be represented in this new technological domain.
Well, again, if I portrayed it as kind of the conventional path and the evangelistic path, the central bank digital currencies are completely the conventional path. You would now have a system which is tax evasion proof, which is fundamentally privacy proof, even though cross our heart, hope to die, stick needle in my eye, we promise we won't look at your data and information. We have, you know, even I've held a whole country's tax information on my laptop, you know, and I'm just a guy from Texas. You know, as a consultant, you go and you get this data just this easily. You don't think the central bank will be working with some grandson of mine, you know, doing the exact same thing? Of course they will. It's no privacy, 100% the ability to pull 100% taxes. And as we saw in cases like Cyprus, they'll take it from you whether they have the right to or whether you want them to or not. Complete oversight over everything you purchase, over everything you consume. Combine that with a search history and you've got something that no Orwellian could have ever imagined. So that's the digital currency.
The delusion amongst many people is, oh, we're safe. We're here in the Western Hemisphere. It can't happen to us. It happened in Argentina. It happened in Cyprus. You're not safe. And you know, many a libertarian would say in a truly free market economy, nation states wouldn't be issuing currency. Individual creditors would be issuing their own currency.
And of
course, you had that in America, and it didn't work out with different banks issuing their own currency at one time, so that function had to be centralized. But I guess that comes to my next query, which is,
well, can I stop you there for a
sure,
moment?
Go on, please.
Is that it? The jury is still not in on that example you gave about the banks and the currencies. From Texas, you know, a bank would come up, they would make their own currency. Another bank would come up, they'd make their own currency. Eventually, it had to be centralized. Now, an economist would say the reason why it failed is because of information problems. We didn't have the technology we have today. You know, if we could see the both bank solvency, you know, on a real-time basis, we would have been happy to accept this bank's note as well as this bank's note. There would have been perfect exchange markets. There would have, in other words, this kind of utopia I was describing for Texas and the taco, and you know, it could have been in the 1800s had the technology not been there. So instead of a central bank digital currency, personally, I would love to see an anti-central bank digital currency, an individual digital currency, if you will, or a community, a digital currency, Kennedytown digital currency, which was freely floating against the Kowloon digital currency, right? And there's nothing against it economically or even technologically.
But if we look at the 19th century American example, isn't it asking for trouble to let the states be the issuer of the currency, and that a difficult state could impede progress by saying, no, we're not going to recognize your currency, and that impedes nationwide interstate commerce?
Well, we're back to government. Remember I said government twists and distorts things.
Yeah.
If you can keep government out of it, then the free market, people in the free market will take something valuable in exchange for something else valuable. It's as simple as that.
That entrepreneurs at street level on the ground, those doing the deal, making the trade, negotiating the terms, they'll figure it out. If there's a deal to be cut, and if someone wants something for value badly enough, they'll make the deal happen.
Black markets have existed for millions of years.
Even in the Soviet Union. I mean, that speaks volumes as to the...
That's right.
You know, the functioning of that society.
We call those optimal currency zones, by the way. Whether a state, a locality, a nation should issue its own currency. And so while we take it for granted that a country, or we may even be daring and say, oh, a state might issue its own currency. For an economist, there's no reason why an individual, looking at costs and benefits, you know, shifting supply and demand curves, why an individual can't form an optimal currency or a family, an optimal currency zone. Right? Open the mind.
You've used the term Gilded Age a few times during our conversation. And the original Gilded Age connoted a certain concentration of wealth at the top. But if we're being honest, people these days will point to the democratization of technology, the democratization of people able to create their own wealth, their own value, to some degree, the democratization of finance through crowdfunding. Is it really that rigid of a time that you're calling it a second Gilded Age? And you, as you pointed out, the solution to that is decentralization. But is it really as bad as a second Gilded Age? Or I mean, are you basing that on the concentration of wealth at the top, based on the Gini coefficient?
Exactly. I'm basing that on data that every economist accepts from Piketty and Sayers, showing the inequality in income over the last, 200-300 years. And if we look at the inequality and we say, well, technology has never, you know, given more opportunities to people than now, you know, now is the best time for people to earn money because of technology. If you look at the facts, we've never had higher concentrations of company power, we call it market power, the ability to price above cost in most of the sectors, in most advanced economies, not to mention developing ones, right? I mean, just look at the way Alphabet and Google got whacked by the competition, by the EU Commissioner for Competition, for billions of dollars. And because the EU ports found there can be no alternative to Google. Alphabet, the company, parent company. Simply not possible. There and not only is it concentrated, but it's impossible to smash them up like we could with Standard Oil 100 years ago. And that's what's frightening, and that's why we call it surveillance capitalism. It's because it act not only does it control us, but it actually shapes us to wanting the things that it that these companies want us to buy from them. And that was the whole big idea behind the surveillance capitalism idea.
Well, conditioned behavior and consumption.
Exactly, is that Google and Facebook, they're showing us ads, basically conditioning us, telling us what we want to buy, completely changing our consumption basket, our educational baskets, our choice to have children, you name it, right? And that's a kind of power that extends well beyond the market.
Or even the acceptable debate, acceptable window of political debate. For example. In the time we've got left, is there anything you feel we should have discussed that you didn't mention the floor is yours?
No, I think just the only thing I wanted to say is that many people are looking at fintech as the way of achieving sustainable development and something called the Sustainable Development Goals. So, you know, the UN has been pushing 17 Sustainable Development Goals. They're hoping that fintech will be the magic bullet, that's the way to go. And I think the point I would like to make is that because we have so many states that have completely collapsed, because we have so many financial markets that have failed to even start to evolve, it's going to be fintech or bust. It's either going to be like you see the videos in Yemen, or they're going to get, because these small communities are going to be able to develop and find apps in ways where they create their own little local financial markets for goods, services, transactions, in a way that makes life bearable. And that's it, because there's not going to be a governmental alternative. That's it.
And as you've talked about fintech, regtech, Web3, and again, at the heart of this is what does it mean for Generation Z? What will the Zoomers face? Any advice for our students who are going to be facing this brave new world? What should they know? I mean, coming from backgrounds in law and finance, not all of them are going to be techies, but exactly. Their world will be invariably shaped by these technologies. What should we say to them? What should we impart to them?
We should say to them, don't just learn the law and apply it. Go to a place that teaches you critical thinking skills, because there's something called intergenerational Strauss. I typed it to you earlier. It's called... Let me look it up. Strauss something, intergenerational theory. I forget the name of the two guys now, but there's a famous theory that even in the American Congress.
Oh, Strauss-Howe generation.
Yeah. Strauss-Howe. So yep. What they say is that every generation goes through four cycles. And at the end of that cycle, there's some kind of complete collapse of society where everything kind of starts again. Right. And I can't say if that's true or false. I'm an economist. I stick to my lane. But I would say to Generation Alpha, especially, whatever crises you're going to go through, don't look to our modern institutions as the way of building back what you need, to make your own life satisfying. Look to these new technologies and look to the rules that make sense for them. I believe that if you're in Generation Alpha, that's going to be something neighborhood focused, but you're the one that's going to have to decide that, young man, young woman.
Well, it's a conversation we should pick up at some point. It's as events play out, I guess watch this space, because this story isn't done yet. Brian, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
And to our audience, our viewers and listeners, thank you. Until next time.